everyone. I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And we are historians. If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We're going to talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And once again, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this?
We'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which Claire and I are presently enjoying occupancy in what we call Melbourne today. That is, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, whose land was stolen and whose sovereignty was never ceded.
And if you noticed that we have some different music playing on the intro to our podcast today, that's because on Archive Fever we have the great pleasure of being in the same room as filmmaker Catherine Dwyer, and that music is from her fantastic documentary feature film Brazen Hussies. If you're listening to this podcast in Australia, you would have had to have been living under a rock these past few months if you haven't come across a screening, a review, or an award ceremony that doesn't feature Catherine's first full-length documentary film, Brazen Hussies. Brazen Hussies uncovers the rich history of the women who brought the women's liberation movement to Australia in the late 1960s and 1970s, told through contemporary interviews with many of the original activists, mixed with extraordinary archival footage. The Age newspaper has called the film a must-watch and given it a rare 5-star rating. Now, prior to writing and directing her own feature film, Catherine worked as a producer, editor, and researcher on other people's films, notably the acclaimed American documentary She's Beautiful When She's Angry. Catherine holds a BA in Cinema Studies and French from the University of Melbourne, and she joins us today in our beautiful Bundoora studios. Welcome to Archive Fever, Catherine.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Catherine, Brazen Hussies is an absolute scorcher of a documentary. Eve and I have both watched it many times over now, both in socially distant cinemas and ABC iView and various online events because it came out in the middle of COVID. So the first thing I want to say is just a big fat congratulations because I know what a massive effort it took you to get this thing made. I first met you at the very start of your journey, and maybe we can come back to that process of getting the film made and particularly the nuts and bolts of the research. But first I'd like to ask you, when you first got bitten by the archive bug?
I'm not sure. It could have happened earlier, but it definitely happened when I worked on She's Beautiful When She's Angry. It was like hunting for treasure, and I love that feeling. It kind of feels like I'm a detective trying to solve a big case. Looking for archive footage from the women's liberation movement is really difficult, and sometimes it was literally buried. Like, there was some footage that Mary Dore found of Eleanor Holmes Norton, who's a senator in the US, and it just said black woman speaking, and it was in a film canister, and she just took the gamble of getting it processed to find out what it was, and it turned out to be some really valuable footage of her speaking about black women in the women's movement. That kind of discovery really excited me.
That smoking gun feeling.
Yeah.
And so what does archive fever feel like for you? Paint us a picture of the visceral effect it has on you.
It really is like a fever. I get very obsessive about finding things. There's still a few mysteries that I haven't solved from making the film. I read about Zelda Duprano, who's in the film, who sadly passed away before the film was finished, going on the Mike Douglas show with Bob Hawke, and apparently Bob Hawke was being really sexist. And I really wanted to find this footage, and we searched high and low, but it just seems to have been deleted, like a lot of TV archives have been.
So Brazen Hussies takes us back to an era that for many viewers will be part of their living memory, the late 60s and 70s. You weren't even born then. What leads a young woman to spend half of her life recreating on the screen this particular period of history?
Well, I guess it was that sense that I knew it was there, but it hadn't been shown before. So again, it takes me back to when I first saw a teaser for She's Beautiful When She's Angry, and I just got goosebumps, and I thought, I have to work on this film because they were finally showing me something that I knew had to have existed. I knew the second wave women's movement had happened, but I hadn't seen very many details besides the sort of 50s housewife suddenly becoming angry. That was kind of like the only thing that I knew.
That's the sense of the motivation, that you wanted to see it.
Yeah.
And that's what I find really interesting about it, that it wasn't you just wanted to read about it, because you can read books about the women's lib movement in the 1970s, but you hadn't seen it, is what you said.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess there's something about seeing it in action that is really compelling. And I was obviously emboldened by my experience on She's Beautiful When She's Angry, working on that film and going through that process of, geez, will anyone watch this? Will this be any good? To seeing it come out into the world and being so well received. Like, I knew that if I did the research and put the archive together, that there would be an amazing story here in Australia. But, you know, it did take a long time to convince funders that it would be an interesting story.
So just take us back a bit there, because you've referenced it a couple of times. It's obviously a very important part of your own personal history, is working on that film, She's Beautiful When She's Angry. How did you get involved in that in the first place?
Well, I was living in Brooklyn at the time, and I'd done a short course in editing, and I was looking for an internship on a film. And it was actually through the Australian Facebook group Destroy the Joint. They posted a link to She's Beautiful's Kickstarter campaign. That's where I saw the teaser, and I saw that they were in Brooklyn as well, so I contacted them straight away and said, can I intern for you? Had sort of an interview with Mary, and she wanted to make sure that I knew at least a little bit about women's liberation. I guess I proved it with my passion, because I didn't actually know that much. I think Kate Millett was probably the only feminist from that time who was in the film that I knew of. I just was really committed and made sure that they sort of needed me around.
So having, you know, developed this passion for women's liberation and deciding you wanted to show what it looked like in Australia, how did you begin to sort of go about finding the archives where that footage was located? Did you go straight to state archives or the ABC or private archives or a mix of all of them?
Yeah, a mix. I mean, sorry to harp on about She's Beautiful, but it really did teach me a lot. So it taught me a lot of research skills. And I think I'd already contacted the ABC looking for footage for the American version of the big 1970s strike for equality. I knew that the ABC had some stuff. What else did I do? I think I was back in Australia and I was home in Perth for Christmas, and I just sort of Googled Women's Liberation Perth and found an academic, Alison Bartlett, and she edits an online journal called Outskirts. And so I actually just wrote to her and said, hey, I want to make this film. Would you like to have a cup of coffee with me? And she actually gave me this book that was really fantastic that she had put together with Margaret Henderson, another academic. And it's called Things That Liberate, A Feminist Wunderkammer. And it's a collection of stories by women that were in the women's movement. And that's where I read Suzanne Bellamy's story about Vera Figner, who was this made-up character that they authorized all their pamphlets with.
Yeah, tell us that story, because it's a great scene in the film and it gets a huge laugh in the cinema with an audience there.
Yeah, I loved that story so much. Suzanne Bellamy talks about how they came up with Vera Figner because pamphlets and newsletters had to be authorized by someone, otherwise they could be seized. And Suzanne was part of a women's liberation newspaper collective called Me Jane. And so they authorized Me Jane with Vera Figner's name. Then I think Sue Wills, the historian, found evidence of Vera Figner in the ASIO files. So apparently they were cataloguing her as a person of interest in Sydney.
Was Vera Figner actually a real person?
So Vera Figner was a Russian revolutionary from the 19th century, and she was part of a plot to assassinate the Tsar. Maybe she did. I'm not sure exactly. She tried to blow him up. She might have succeeded. I can't remember.
And yes. Miraculously turns up in 1970s.
Yeah, Sydney Women's Liberation. Apparently they also would use her name if they got arrested at a protest. Or apparently she also managed to get a bank account in her name. We actually did try and search arrest records for Vera Figner's name, but we weren't able to turn up
Well, speaking of revolutions, one of the women you interview, Biff Ward, says of the women's liberation movement, and this is a quote from the film, "It was a revolution, and people who make revolutions get burnt and hurt and distorted and go a bit crazy. All sorts of things happen, but it's also completely exhilarating." So do people who remake revolutions from the archives up also go a bit crazy, Catherine?
Yes, definitely. Probably in a much less confrontational way, just in internal crazy making. I think actually being in the revolution, it would be quite difficult and quite taxing having all of those arguments. Like, it wasn't always easy to be in the women's liberation movement. I think there were a lot of fallings out and big ideological splits, and I preferred to research that than actually be involved in those arguments.
Revolution from a distance.
Yeah.
So can you describe what a typical day in the archives looked like for you? Because, like, even I would know what it would be like to walk into the National Library of Australia and go up to the special collections and get our trolley with our boxes and, you know, sit at the table and go through our documents. And that's a very explicit experience for us. But what does it look like for you to do archival research?
Yeah, well, not being an academic probably played a part in it. It was a bit all over the place. I would just sort of find deep veins of material and mine them for gold, really. I started with Marilyn Lake's book, Getting Equal, and then you start to accumulate names that pop up over and over again, and it gives you references to the source material. So the Victorian Women's Liberation and Lesbian Feminist Archives at Melbourne Uni were a big source of archives. So I went there and went through Zelda's archives, and that's where I discovered the Council for the Single Mother and Her Children, which got me onto that story, which was really interesting because single mothers are kind of not often remembered as being part of the revolution. I guess it also depends on funding as well. So for a long time I was fundraising and looking for funds, and then when we actually got production funds, we could hire a researcher to go and find those newspaper clippings. So it was really great to have that kind of assistance. And one of the most exciting archive discoveries was going to the National Archives and going through ASIO files and finding little 12-year-old Sigrid Thornton at an abortion rally with her parents. It was a photo of her, and she's all dressed in white and she's carrying a women's liberation flag. But we also then ended up turning up some film footage of her as well, which ended up in the film.
Because am I correct in thinking that Sigrid Thornton's mother, Merle Thornton, was one of the women who chained herself to the bar in the Regatta Hotel in Brisbane in 1965 to protest women being excluded?
That was such a great connection, and it's so fabulous that Sigrid narrates the TV version, because she gets to actually talk about how it was possibly one of her first film roles, being in the ASIO footage.
And was there any really amazing piece of footage that you discovered that for whatever reason you couldn't use in the film because of editing or because of copyright issues or anything like that?
There were a lot of stories that I wanted to tell that I couldn't. Often it was because there wasn't enough visual evidence to show it. And there's just so many stories. Mm. So we're actually thinking of doing a podcast series. One of my favourite stories that didn't end up in the film is about a protest that Beatrice Faust organised just after forming the Women's Electoral Lobby. And in the film, they did a big survey and it had a huge impact on the election. But one of their first actions was to protest in Victoria the public service entrance exams. So these were exams that only men could take to get into the senior management positions of the public service. So they gathered all these women with ambiguous sounding names, Hillary, and I think there was a Beata. They applied to take the exam and then they got approved to take it because they couldn't tell they were women. The organisers tried to stop them from taking the exam, but there were protesters there and media there, so they got to do it.
So is that a story that you could tell via podcast because you got people can talk about it, but you couldn't tell in Brazen Hussies because you didn't actually have any visual archive to support it?
Well, we didn't have visual archive, and also Beatrice Faust had sadly passed away, but she's not the only one who could tell the story. And what's really frustrating is that I know that ASIO was there taking photographs of the event, but we couldn't track down the images. So I know that there's so much more material that ASIO created that I haven't been able to get my hands on yet, and maybe one day I will.
So there'll be a sequel, hopefully.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. One of my favourite articles about the protest, the headline is PS, which is public service, made to look like a lot of nongs. And that was in The Age.
We don't hear enough Australian vernacular in the press these days, do we? So it sounds like what you're saying is that as an organising principle or methodologically, unless you have the visual footage, you can't tell the story. So were there stories you wanted to tell that you went searching for visual archive, or did you do it the other way around, that you'd find visual archive and then say, right, this is the story we've got to tell?
Yeah, it was actually both those things. So often I would find footage, say like Gillian Ley being interviewed about being in the women's liberation, and then think, oh, well, I've got to track down Gillian Ley, because wouldn't it be great to see her younger self and then her older self talking? I really wanted it to be an Australia-wide history, and I wanted to avoid it being just about Melbourne and Sydney, but because of the archives that we were able to uncover, it did end up being very Sydney and Melbourne heavy. But also, documentary filmmakers now are doing a lot with animation to tell stories that there aren't visual stuff with, which is what we did with Vera Figner.
You also raise another kind of issue there. Brazen Hussies doesn't demur from the fact that there were factional tensions among the second wave feminists. The term wasn't used in the 1970s, but we'd now say that intersectional feminism was a major sort of divisive element in the movement. How much harder was it to find footage of lesbian or black or migrant women than the mainstream middle class Germaine Greer or university politics version of women's lib?
I guess the very fact that the Victorian Women's Liberation Lesbian Feminist Archives were created by lesbians meant that there is quite a lot of lesbian material that's been recorded and kept. But yes, it was much more difficult to try and find Aboriginal involvement in the women's movement. It's not that women in the women's liberation movement weren't aware of the issues and weren't interested in Aboriginal women, but finding the stuff where Aboriginal women were actually organising for themselves, there was less material. And actually, Marcia Langton is someone who I really wanted to speak to, because there was a Black Women's Action Group and she's the only one left alive to talk about it. And hopefully, maybe she'll do an interview for the podcast.
Well, you know, one of the great things about this film is you've made it at a time when a lot of the key actors are still alive. So, you know, you have the film is a mix of archival footage and present day interviews, which occurred to me is a kind of interesting tension, because we all know that memory is very fallible. So did you ever have situations where the stories people were telling in the interviews kind of contradicted what you'd found in the footage? Was there sort of tensions between one archive and the other?
That's a good question. The only thing I can think of is Kate Jennings' speech. It is interesting how people remember things differently. And Suzanne Bellamy remembered it really well, and she told it really well. She's like talking about how Martha and Sarah had a stick in her hand. And I talked to Martha about it, and Martha didn't really have any particularly interesting memories about that event. It just didn't mean...
So she didn't remember the stick.
She didn't remember the stick.
It's a really pivotal scene in the film. I was absolutely awestruck by Kate Jennings' speech there. Where did you come across that bit of footage?
The only documentation of Kate Jennings' speech is one photograph of her giving the speech, and we don't even know who took it. It's unknown photographer. And I scoured archives looking for it, because the State Library of New South Wales have the negatives of the Tribune, which was the communist magazine, which are an amazing resource. They've got a Creative Commons license. So there's amazing documentation of that era. And I was clicking through photograph after photograph trying to find Kate Jennings giving the speech, but I never did. But because we had all of that documentation, and we had an amazing film about the anti-Vietnam War movement, so we sort of collaged crowds and the reaction together.
Maybe I'm remembering it wrongly, but you have got footage of her actually delivering the speech though, don't you?
No, that's actually me. Oh, reenacting the speech.
Oh my goodness,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, good job. I never
that
would
was
have
my
known
Hitchcock
that.
Moment. No, there's actually just a photograph, and then there's the reenactment, which you can hear, and you can see footage of a anti-Vietnam War crowd.
Yeah.
But it's actually not the event.
Oh, well, I've spliced it all together in my own brain.
That's the power of film.
Yeah,
well,
there you go. It's a testament to your excellent filmmaking that it's, because I was convinced by that as well.
It is a testament to the excellent editing of my editor, Rosie Jones, who did like such an amazing job.
So you talk about Creative Commons there. You know, I'm struck by the fact that when historians use material that they've found in the traditional paper archives, all it takes is a pen and a notebook to jot it down and, you know, or a laptop or a phone camera these days. And then they can capture the quote and then you can reproduce it. You might need to make an acknowledgement of the National Library or something. But I imagine that film footage is really expensive.
Very expensive.
To reproduce. So tell us, how expensive?
Well, my fabulous producers, Andrea Foxworthy and Philippa Campy, got a deal with the ABC. So the ABC are one of the investors in the film, and they basically invested $250,000 worth of archive footage, which meant I had complete access to their archives and could use whatever I wanted. So that's how much that footage is worth, I guess.
That's amazing.
Yeah. On top of that, we had films from the NFSA, the National Film and Sound Archive, and other TV networks. So, yeah, it costs a lot of money to license that stuff, which is interesting because in America they have fair use laws. Mm. So if you can get your hands on the footage and have a good reason, you don't have to license it at all.
I remember when I was making the Utopia Girls documentary, which is about the suffrage movement, and there's a very pivotal bit of archive, which is the moment that Emily Wilding Davidson throws herself in front of the horse at Epsom and is killed. You know, absolute, has to be on any highlights reel of the suffragette movement. It was going to cost $10,000 for the 30 seconds that it took her to get run over by the horse.
That's highway robbery.
Well, it's owned by Pathé or something. And yeah, I mean, that's their business, is selling that bit of footage.
Wow.
And Catherine, one of the other aspects of the film that really makes it sing, literally, is the soundtrack, which is so much fun and so energetic. And I've watched the film 3 times now, and every time I appreciate the soundtrack a little bit more. So can you tell us a bit about choosing that? What sound archives did you use and how did that all come together?
I love the soundtrack as well, so thank you. I have a wonderful friend called Guy Blackman who has a record label called Chapter Music, and he is, I guess, obsessive like me and had sort of just been collecting mainly queer and women's music. I mean, he collects a lot of things, but had accumulated over 20 years of being a record store obsessive some women's music. So we talked about it and I said, oh, if we ever get the funding to make this film, you should be the music supervisor. But also in doing the research, I've discovered a lot of the bands as well, like there was a band called Clitoris, Toxic Shock from Melbourne. They're a punk band that Fran Kelly was in, Fran Kelly from the ABC. So, yeah, Guy actually sort of just digitized this music and gave it to me. And then also there was Cable Ties, who are a contemporary band whose sound just was so perfect for the film, I had to use it. When it came to actually putting the soundtrack together, we had to do some digging to find a particular singer, Pip Porter. She had this record. I think she worked on The Coming Out Show, which was like a feminist radio show on the ABC in the 70s. And she had written a bunch of songs, I think, that were supposed to accompany the subjects of the show. So she wrote a song about the first woman train driver, The Ballad of Janet Ogden. And she'd put this record out, but it was very obscure and she'd changed her name. We had a really hard time finding her and we finally did. And it was great to catch up with her and learn about her music.
Catherine, we've talked many times on Archive Fever about the particular anxiety that accompanies archival research, knowing that so much of the great material that you've uncovered will never make it into the final product. You know, it's what Greg Denning, who I had in first year history at Melbourne Uni, called the iceberg of history. All anybody's ever going to see is the tip that's above the surface, but it has to be sitting on this great edifice of archival research below it that no one will ever see. So how much of your research literally ended up on the cutting room floor?
Oh, wow, so much. That just really captures it, doesn't it? This iceberg with this much larger mass underneath the surface. A big issue for me was trying to database my research because it's a visual medium. I wanted an easy way to search for images. So I ended up creating a database and we've got over 4,000 images in that database. So that's just images. It's not even the all of the footage archive. That's a separate archive. I think we've got about 800 in there.
So you've done all this incredible work that it seems to me is really valuable in itself as an archive, let alone the interviews that you've done. I mean, you've really created your own archive by interviewing all these women who were part of the Women's Lib movement. What do you intend to do with your own archive? Is this something that other people might be able to access one day if they want to use it for their own projects or book research or podcasts or anything?
Yeah, I'll have to clean it up because it's a big mess, but I really should make it available because it is very valuable. We've talked about maybe like putting an exhibition together of video and photographs and artworks because there's just so much. We're discussing the possibility of doing that as well. I have to say the filmmakers of the film For Love or Money, who made a very rich archival history of women and work in Australia, they did an amazing job of cataloguing their research. So they've kind of actually set a bar that I should probably try to match. Their resources that they created were so helpful to me. It was basically like, here's a guide to where you can find all this feminist archives.
And this seems to me to be a particularly kind of feminist project, which is collaboration, sharing, passing the story on. You know, in itself, that makes sense that feminists would want to share the feminist history that they've discovered with other feminists.
Yeah, definitely. I just have to mention also that Alva Gecki's, after I interviewed her, she had all her archives at her house and she ended up driving them down from Lennox Head to my house in Melbourne, and they sat in boxes in my lounge room for over a year, maybe 2 years, and they were such an important resource for me. So I would just sort of get home and start digging through the box and find all these amazing headlines and photographs. And yeah, a lot of the material came from those archives. Mm. So shout out to Alba.
And I can imagine there's a lot of other kind of personal archives of women's liberation out there as yet undiscovered. When we think about all the women throughout Australia who are still alive in their 60s, 70s, 80s with boxes crammed into their front room, I know my mum certainly has her own personal archive she's building up. What would she recommend to those people who are got all this material that they think researchers might be interested in or someone might use for a book or a film? Would you recommend they donate it to a certain institution?
That's actually interesting because the reason Alva brought her archives to me is because we were going to get them into the Melbourne Uni Archives with Zelda's, but they seem to be under-resourced, so I don't know what's going on there. So yeah, libraries and archives are actually struggling at the moment to get the funding from this government, which is very sad. So I'm not sure. Digitize it, please. But it is amazing how much we can do today to capture archives. Like, you know, just going into the archives and taking pictures on your phone changes the game a lot.
Yes, the base of the iceberg just grows and grows.
It does.
In a way, almost by coincidence, you could say. The release of your film has coincided with this period of hugely resurgent feminist activism in Australia. In some ways, as you know, the biggest rallies and protests we've seen since women's liberation have been happening across Australia in March 2021. For you, having just immersed yourself in the archives of Women's Lib, what's kind of changed and what stayed the same in the look and the feel of these protests? So are you seeing the same protest tactics being reused?
I hope so. I mean, when I learnt about the Women's Electoral Lobby and the survey that they did, I really felt like, oh, I'd love an impact result of the film to be that women did that survey again today. And now there's talks that they are organising that. So that's really exciting. I think, you know, sometimes you can feel overwhelmed about all the things that need changing in the world. And it's really helpful to go back and look at what people did in the past and to see that it actually is possible to make change, because sometimes it can feel a bit like, where do you even start? And it starts with collectivity, I guess, women getting together.
And we don't always need to reinvent the wheel. We can learn from strategies that we've used before.
Claire, actually, there's a quote from when we first met in 2016. You'd given a speech at a feminist conference, and it was about how, you know, women are so often erased from history, or we're told we didn't do anything when in actual fact we did. We just need our stories to be told. I mean, that's not your quote, but you said something like that.
one of the interviewees in your film says, and we need that history to be told over and over and over again. Catherine, thank you for telling us that history. You've told us here today that it started from quite a humble ambition, although a massive challenge in front of you, which is to see the revolution.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And you've given it to us. You really have. Yeah, I took my 15-year-old daughter to see it, and particularly in that final fist-pumping montage where you blend all that archival footage of 50 years ago with scenes from contemporary footage of marches. And now, as Eve says, we could add to that the March for Justice if we ever do a Brazen Hussies redux. It's an incredible thing that you have made from the ground up, and we owe you a great debt, I think, because you have given that history back to all of us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Now, Catherine, we're going to have to wrap things up, even though we could obviously talk about the film all day. But before we end, we'd like to ask you a question we ask all our guests here on Archives Anonymous, which is, do you have a dirty little archive secret you'd be willing to share with us?
Do I have a dirty little archive secret? I did keep one of the equal pay pamphlets from Alva's archives. There were just so many of them and I wanted to keep one for myself. But it's from Melbourne from the early 70s and it says equal pay in English, Greek and Italian.
A little bit of archival souveniring, we understand.
Now, well, I've got to admit to Alva what I did.
Well, if you say 10 Hail Marys to the female god, we will forgive you. You are absolved in our archival feverish eyes. Catherine, thank you so much for coming along today. It's been really fascinating to talk to you. Don't forget, everybody, that you can catch up on all of Season 1 and Season 2 of Archive Fever via our website, archivefeverpod.com. And you can learn more about Brazen Hussies at the fabulous website www.brazenhussies.com.au. You can even buy your own Brazen Hussies merch, as I just did, including a great I'm a Brazen Hussy t-shirt or a pair of women's lib undies inspired by the pants worn by Elizabeth Reid in her interview with Gough Whitlam. I can't wait for mine to come through the post. In the 1970s, Women's Electoral Lobby Canberra made these undies to raise money for their activism, and the team at Brazen Hussies is raising money now to get the messages of this film out, not just to Australia, but to the world. Smashing the patriarchy one pair of knickers at a time.
So until next time, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
You can follow Brazen Hussies on Twitter at @Brazen_Hussies.
And Claire's on Twitter at Claire A. Wright.
And you can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees.